Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary, filling in for Larry this week while he takes some time off. Later this hour, UCLA's Dr. Peter Katona joins us to talk about the latest COVID-19 news, including the potential indoor mask mandate in LA County, which could go into effect as early as tomorrow. We're expecting word later today from the County Health Department about that. Also this hour, how do you know when the time is right to give your child a smartphone? There's no right answer. It's different for every child. But a new questionnaire co-authored by the American Academy of Pediatrics aims to help parents figure out the right time for their child. We'll talk with a pediatrician who helped write the new guide and take calls from parents who might be navigating this challenging decision right now. But we begin this hour talking about the pandemic's toll on expecting and new parents. The birthing process can take a toll on a person from prenatal care issues following the birth, like postpartum depression. And with this in mind, folks have looked to address this through accessible forms of mental health care. A common method is through perinatal psychiatry. But how accessible is it at a time when lots of folks are finding themselves with heightened anxiety during the pandemic? Joining us to talk about her recent piece on all this is Ellie Yu, investigative reporter for KPCC and LAist. Her most recent piece for LAist is titled Why the Pandemic Took an Especially High Mental Health Toll on New Parents. Ellie, thank you so much for joining.
Hi, Sharon.
Hey there. And to our listeners, if you're someone who had a child during the pandemic, we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page, and we always want to know where you're from. So, Ellie, first off, I know you wrote this for parents everywhere, but you're a new mom yourself, a pandemic mom, so to speak. You had your first child during the pandemic. Was it that made you decide to dig into this topic?
It's partly why I wanted to dig into this topic. I gave birth to my son last year, so I, you know, everything from my pregnancy to birth to the postpartum period has been in the pandemic. You know, and for me, I didn't really have much to compare my experience to. So in many ways, I thought, the pandemic was just sort of the norm for me. You know, becoming a new parent must be stressful and hard. And I thought, you know, that's just the way it is. And, you know, that is true. But hearing from other parents that had given birth to kids before the pandemic, I realized that, you know, the experience, you know, was not the norm. It was totally different. And many parents felt a lot more stress, anxiety, and sadness. And that was something I wanted to look into. And, you know, there's research that's been coming out that's showing just that.
You wrote that one in three birthing parents experienced postpartum depression, and that's up from one in eight before the pandemic. What were some of the big takeaways from your reporting?
Yeah, so pregnant people have always been vulnerable to mood and anxiety disorders. I do mention the one in eight number, but yeah, that rate tripled when the pandemic hit. And, you know, it fits into sort of what I've been hearing from people who've given birth over the last couple years. You know, the pandemic itself was so anxiety producing. Pregnant people, for one, are at more risk of severe illness, for instance, if they catch COVID-19. The labor and delivery experience was completely different. People were going to their prenatal appointments by themselves, you know, at times where they could be getting sort of really difficult news from doctors. And, you know, there was a lot of anxiety through that. People couldn't bring in more than one support person at times to their delivery. So people were choosing between their partner or their mom or their doula, or sometimes giving birth alone because if people tested positive, you couldn't bring anyone in. And, you know, when people went home, you know, support was also limited because of the pandemic. And then on top of all this, you know, the past 2.5 years have been a very stressful time overall. you know, we've seen in the news school shootings to the murder of George Floyd. There's also a formula shortage. And so there's a lot of issues that have just been compounded.
Just a huge pile on of stuff. So, what is California's mental health care system offering in the way of pre or postnatal care for people experiencing all this?
So the state in 2019 started mandating that providers who see women and birthing people in the prenatal and postpartum period to offer mental health screenings or make sure that they're screened. So these are often short questionnaires that ask questions like, you know, in the past 7 days, have you been able to see the funny side of things or have you felt sad? It's supposed to help screen for mood disorders during this time. And advocates say it's been a great first step, you know, in sort of marrying mental health care with physical health care. But the issue sort of, the issue is what happens after you screen positive. Treatment is still limited, you know, and patients can often face hurdles or long wait times in finding a mental health care provider. They, you know, are often given maybe a long list of numbers to call and something, you know, that's something new parents who just gave birth don't necessarily have the energy to do. And some woman I spoke to also told me that, you know, the questionnaires can often feel impersonal, right. That they were often just doing this sort of paperwork that they filled out. And they weren't really talking through with someone in real time about what they were feeling. And then plus in the pandemic, a lot of these, you know, visits, postpartum visits were over the phone. And so that just made it even more impersonal.
Wow. Well, if you're an expecting parent out there, a birthing person, or you recently had a child, we do want to hear from you. Or if you have a question for our guests, give us a call, 866-893-5722, or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. So for postnatal care, Ellie, we're speaking with Ellie Yu, our investigative reporter who wrote about all of this. What kind of care fits under that postnatal care and how necessary is it for new parents, specifically mental health postnatal care?
So there usually is one postpartum visit, you know, that's usually around 6 weeks. And, you know, a lot of advocates say that's not enough.
Yeah, by 6 weeks. I mean.
And a lot of the mental health issues can sort of present itself after the 6 week period. The postpartum period technically is 1 year after birth. And so many times those mental health issues might not be flagged during that postpartum visit because it's just, you know, one visit. And then in the pandemic, as I mentioned, this has sort of turned a lot of times these visits have been virtual. And so, you know, things were just flying under the radar even more in terms of mental health issues.
That just sounds like exceptionally difficult for a person to go 6 weeks without, you know, checking in or getting an evaluation. How has that access changed during the pandemic?
You know, it hasn't changed as very much. I mean, the screenings are still happening or are supposed to be happening. You know, some new moms that I spoke to said, you know, they took the initiative on their own to find mental health care support. Like they recognized that they needed help and reached out to a therapist on their own. They weren't necessarily flagged by the healthcare system that they had a mood or anxiety issue. And so, you know, they took the initiative on their own to find a therapist, but that's hard. You know, not all mental health care providers often take your insurance. You know, it's hard to navigate complicated websites, making those calls. But there have been other, you know, there has been a mom I spoke to who also found a peer support group that was helpful for her to talk to other moms who have who birthed a child during the same period and talk through emotional and mental health issues.
Well, Ella, I want to bring into the conversation Erin Sritraroon. She's events coordinator for Maternal Mental Health Now. She gave birth to her son in the summer of 2020. Erin, what can you tell us about how you're feeling and how that helped?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me. I gave birth to my son in June of 2020. So a couple months into the pandemic, it was a really interesting experience to go from pre-pandemic care to post-pandemic care and to see the huge transition between that. And I did experience postpartum anxiety after the birth of my son, but we're doing great now, a couple years later.
So you found it very helpful to be around others and get that support.
Yes. So I was able to go find care on my own. So I do work for Maternal Mental Health Now, which does amazing work around reducing the barriers and stigma associated with perinatal mental health disorders for those in Los Angeles County. And so I knew the signs and symptoms. I knew what to be looking for myself. And yet I was able to sort of fly under the radar given COVID. My one and only postnatal visit at 6 weeks was over the phone, and it lasted maybe 10 minutes, and it was all about my own self-reporting. Nobody had eyes on me. And so I knew anxiety was a part of my story, but I was able in that conversation to feel like I don't know this person. I'm not really able to open up to them well. I can't even see their face. And so I'm not really going to get into my mental health in this, you know, sort of scenario.
Erin, if that's what you experienced and this is something you work in, clearly many, many others are going to be feeling it too. Thank you so much for your call. Let's turn now to the real expert, Dr. Misty Richards. She's an assistant clinical professor and the medical director of perinatal psychiatry at UCLA. Dr. Richards, thank you so much for being with us.
So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And if you're an expecting parent, we would like to hear from you. 866-893-5722, a birthing person or recently had a child. You can email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. Dr. Richards, tell me about the work you do at the UCLA Maternal Outpatient Mental Health Services Clinic.
Absolutely. So the UCLA Maternal Outpatient Mental Health Services Clinic, or short, called the Moms Clinic, is in the Department of OB-GYN. It was established in 2019, right after the passing of that California AB 2193 kind of law that mandated that every, you know, person who's pregnant be screened for any type of mental health condition during the perinatal period. So the chair of the Department of OB-GYN realized that many women would probably screen positive for depression during this period of time and wanted to have psychiatric care readily available for them. As such, and in collaboration with a maternal fetal medicine physician, or OB-GYN named Dr. Rashmi Rao, the Moms Clinic was founded. So since we opened the clinic doors, we have been at capacity in terms of referrals for patient care. The Moms Clinic follows this collaborative care clinic model in that it is a mental health clinic that is embedded in the Department of OB-GYN.
Well, so what differences are you seeing in the clinic and the patients explicitly as a result of COVID and during the pandemic?
Yeah, it has been tricky. You know, I will just say it has been a very challenging time for pregnant persons, you know, over the past 2.5 years. You know, since the pandemic, we've seen a 30% increase in referrals to our clinic. This has been just an understandably challenging time to bring a child into the world. The pandemic has resulted in kind of social isolation during a time that's, you know, meant to be celebrated, increased anxiety about the unknown, and then exposed the limitations of multiple systems, including the healthcare system. There's certainly been increased interest in our clinic from both the OB-GYN and patient perspectives.
And what are some of the explicit risks that we're seeing in the COVID era versus previous? I mean, personal isolation is one.
Absolutely. So if you can imagine, you know, when you're in the hospital setting, giving birth, you know, going through labor and delivery, it's a grueling process. And if you're already feeling anxious, and if hospital stays are shortened for whatever reason, and certainly due to COVID protocols, you know, what is compromised in your hospital care? Certainly kind of education about breastfeeding, should you choose to do that, about taking care of your infant, even actual screenings for mental health issues like postpartum depression are compromised. So that's an issue already, you know, due to COVID protocols. And then once a patient is discharged, when they go home and you're experiencing that first week or two on their own, which is already anxiety provoking enough, to do that by yourself, right, and to not have people come in to help you, whether it's relatives or anybody else, is hard.
Let's bring into the conversation quickly Casey Blackman. Casey, you were quoted so compellingly in Ellie's article. What did you find was happening to you during the pandemic as you were preparing to give birth to your child and afterwards?
Just the unknown of whether or not my husband would be able to be with me in the exam room or at the hospital, or my support people that I have, such as my doula, and not knowing if, you know, we were going to catch COVID, or like what happens if you get COVID. Other things were going around, as we know, and has already been mentioned, that, you know, bringing a child who is Black and being profiled, or myself, was I even being safe, or was something going to happen to me? Would I be able to go home? Because we know that maternal mortality is high for Black people. So just being able to know, am I going to be able to go home with my kids after giving birth in the hospital? So a lot of unknown and feeling isolated and anxious.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So it's not just the social isolation, but also the social upheaval, the social justice issues that cropped up. I mean, excuse me, they're longstanding, but were exaggerated and exacerbated in 2020, made you fear for your child health. But thank you for sharing that, Casey. We very much appreciate that. Is that something you're more commonly seeing as well at your clinic?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely a difficult time for, you know, just people in general due to civil unrest. Someone mentioned George Floyd earlier. Mm-hmm. Also, in addition to the social isolation, in addition to the unknown of what would happen if you did, you and your baby contracted COVID.
So much difficult to think about, and so many resources out there. Thank you to our guests for joining today's program, Dr. Misty Richards. She's a medical director of perinatal psychiatry at UCLA. Also joining us was Ellie Yu. She's an investigative reporter for LAist and KPCC. Be sure to check out her recent piece. It's called Why the Pandemic Took an Especially High Mental Health Toll on New Parents. Coming up, UCLA's Dr. Peter Katona joins us for one of our regular COVID-19 updates. As always, we'll take your questions at 866-893-5722, or you can mail them to us at atcomments@kpcc.org. Please include your first name and where you're writing from. I'm Sharon McNary. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
So glad to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary, in for Larry Mantle this week. Coming up, when is the right time to give your kid a smartphone? I'm not even sure I should have one. A new guide co-authored by the American Academy of Pediatrics aims to help you answer that question. We'll talk with a pediatrician who studies the intersection of parenting and mobile technology, and who also helped draft the questionnaire for kids and parents. But right now, as we've been doing regularly since the start of the pandemic, it's time for an update on the latest COVID-19 and vaccine news. With us today is one of our regular contributors, Dr. Peter Katona. He's a professor of epidemiology and a clinical professor of medicine at UCLA, where he teaches at both the Fielding School of Public Health and the David Geffen School of Medicine. Dr. Katona, thank you for coming back on Air Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
As always, we welcome your questions for Dr. Katona at 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page, and we love to see where you're writing from, so include that with your note. Let's start with a question everybody is asking. Will L.A. County return to an indoor mask mandate this week? I mean, earlier this week, it was looking as if it was all but certain, but recently L.A. County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer said in her report to the Board of Supervisors that case numbers and hospitalizations are on the decline, suggesting that the county might be positioned to hold off on the mask mandate. What are you hearing? What would you like to see happen?
Well, CDC has issued some recommendations, and you can take them or not take them. And the recommendations have to do with contagiousness and severity of disease. And LA County has passed the criteria to go into the highest category. And Dr. Farrar has said if that happens and it maintains itself for 2 weeks, that she will reinstitute the masking mandate. Very controversial. Some of the supervisors don't like it.
Right.
Long Beach and Pasadena aren't keen on it. It's not following the rules of the state. So it's somewhat controversial, but that's the way it's looking right now.
Yeah, we know that Fourth District Supervisor Janice Hahn has said she would not support a mask mandate. Supervisor Catherine Barger said during Tuesday's SUPS meeting that she opposes a mandate. And she pointed to an analysis of Alameda County's June 2022 masking mandate. That analysis concluded it had no significant impact. Masking didn't significantly reduce caseloads when compared with neighboring counties that did not impose indoor masking. What data do we have currently with regard to the effectiveness of these mandates?
Well, there's the effectiveness of masking itself, and there's the added effectiveness of instituting a mandate. And I think most experts will agree that masking with a high-quality mask in the right circumstances is helpful. But at the same time, how much more helpful is it to mandate is really the question. And that sliver of difference is what's controversial. But I don't think it's controversial whether masks work or not.
Right. I mean, are we at the point where so many people are vaccinated, if you get COVID, it's more likely to be mild? I mean, I had it in June and it was kind of awful, but, you know, I recovered. Are we at the point where, you know, people aren't going to follow a mandate and you just kind of got to protect yourself against everybody who's breathing heavily on you with no mask?
Well, we're certainly at the point of not everybody agreeing or coming to terms with a mandate. I think that's clear. But whether to reinstitute it or not is a different issue altogether. You know, you get to a certain point where you think you might have what's called herd immunity and the virus runs out of people to infect. But I don't think we're quite there yet with that because of the highly infectious, contagious nature of the virus.
Right. And having a mandate does kind of give cover to people who want to wear masks. They're less likely to feel, you know, like odd person out. Well, this is a question we get frequently. With the Moderna and Pfizer both working on updated versions of their vaccine, which is designed to combat the contagious Omicron variant of COVID-19, should people who are eligible for another booster wait until these updated vaccines are released to get, or should they get their shot right now?
The predominant recommendation at this point is if you are eligible for a third or fourth shot, you should take it. It will not preclude you from being able to take an updated vaccine. And there's several formulations that are in the works now that are projected to come out around October.
We'll wait and see what happens with that. Dr. Peter Katona is with us right now. He's a professor of epidemiology and a clinical professor of medicine at UCLA. We're taking your calls with questions about COVID-19 at 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. So what is your take on the current safety of things like eating out at a restaurant, having a drink at the bar, or going to a large indoor event?
Well, there's clearly a distinction between indoor and outdoor. It doesn't mean you're 100% safe outdoor, but you're safe enough outdoors that you don't need to wear a mask. the higher the concentration of people indoors and the lower the quality of ventilation indoors, the higher the chance of being infected. So indoors is very high risk. Outdoors is very low risk.
We've seen a piece in the LA Times, and it looked at the potential for more cases of long COVID. And one public health expert it quoted said that simply because the number of people who've been infected by this most recent wave means we can expect more long COVID cases to come. Do you agree with that? Are you expecting more long COVID?
Well, for those that say, I just want to get infected and get it over with, my argument is that you're spreading the disease and you're subjecting yourself to more long COVID. We don't really know how often it happens. Estimates go from 5% to 30%. So we don't know because the definition is quite unclear. But some people have these symptoms for a long time. Some people have them indefinitely, at least since the beginning of the outbreak. So one has to be careful because these can be debilitating symptoms of fever and brain fog and lethargy. And so to prevent people from getting long COVID is very important. And that's probably the most important reason to try not to get infected.
It does feel like a gamble. I mean, I was very grateful to get over my case. You know, I was back to normal a couple weeks after I got it. But, I mean, imagine having that go on for months and months and interfere with the normal, you know, daily tasks of life. The people that you see with long COVID, what are they telling you?
Well, they're sorry they got infected. And bear in mind that getting an infection and then getting another infection on top of that increases your chances of getting long COVID. Being unvaccinated increases your chances of getting long COVID. So there are things that can be done, but why take that risk? It's a high risk for something that is likely to not do anything, but still has a fairly high likelihood of causing problems for you.
Well, we do know that there's still a lot of time to travel this summer. Should people mask up on airplanes? I think it's now optional in a lot of places.
I think it's optional at almost all airlines now, both nationally and internationally. You know, the airplane is a tube. It's a closed chamber. It has pretty good ventilation, but it has a lot of people, statistically some of which are likely to be infected at the time of traveling. So my suggestion to people, if they get on an airplane, is to try to get the shortest, most direct route and have as few changes of flight as possible and wear a mask of high quality while you're in the airport or on the plane.
Going back to this issue of kids. We know that kids can get vaccine now. Are the current generation of vaccines effective against the Omicron BA5 variant? That's a question we're getting from Carol in Beverly Hills.
The vaccines that are currently available do help in preventing severe disease for the Omicron most recent variants, the BA5, for example. So they are effective in preventing serious disease. How effective they are in transmission is somewhat more questionable. It seems that you have some immunity to it once you've been given the vaccine, but that doesn't last very long. So the actual effect of the vaccine on contagiousness is not very much.
Yesterday on the program, we talked about the UCLA study. It was a study that combined a lot of international experts, but it pinned the location of the epicenter of the virus on that, you know, live animal market in Wuhan, China. From an epidemiological standpoint, what do you think is valuable to learn from that study about tracing the origins of future viruses?
Well, there are two studies that were just recently released that were peer-reviewed, and one said unlikely to be a lab release, and the other kind of talked about a wave of infections that occurred at the market. So none of these studies ruled out a lab release, and none of these studies actually showed an intermediate host. So in my opinion, we're back to square one in deciding what's happened. It would be a huge coincidence, I might add, that the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the wet market were only 10 or 15 kilometers apart. That's the only place in China that studies these viruses. So that would be a huge coincidence. until we find some intermediate host, because all these coronaviruses that affect humans have been found to have an intermediate host of some kind, whether they're ferrets or camels or something like that, depending on the species.
Wow. What do you think the outlook is moving into the fall and winter months? I mean, we're seeing this current surge. I mean, do you think we'll see another surge similar to what we saw around the holidays last year?
Well, those that have made predictions in the past have often been wrong. So it's really hard to make a prediction. You know, you look at California, it seems like maybe it's getting a little better. LA County seems to be maybe getting a little worse. You know, these are minute steps in a huge, long process. And so it's very technically challenging to make accurate predictions. So I don't know what's going to happen in the fall. I'm hopeful that maybe the newly formulated vaccines will help. Maybe Omicron will run out of susceptibles. I'm trying to take the optimistic stance as much as I can.
So many wrong predictions, but we can always be optimistic. So I'm getting a question here. Like, so if so many people have gotten the infection now, if someone in your household tests positive, is it still the recommendation to separate within the house, or at this point is it even worth it?
I think the recommendation still is if you get infected, you isolate for the first 5 days at least. So whether it's a household or not, I think a lot of people are going to ignore that. But at the same time, the recommendation is still to isolate for 5 days, wear a high quality mask for the subsequent 5 days.
Well, I know early in the pandemic, LA County had created hotel rooms like out at the LA County Fairgrounds and other places for people to isolate if they had the virus. Do you have any idea if those are still functioning and available?
I don't know how functional those are at this point.
Yeah, I think for a lot of households, it's very difficult to isolate because, you know, you're in fairly small quarters. I'm getting a question about monkeypox. We've heard it can spread via clothing and surfaces, so should we be wiping down movie theater seats before sitting in them? Same thing with spreading via clothing. Should we avoid trying on clothes at stores?
Well, I think you have to be practical here. This is a condition that in national estimates, 97% are in cases of men who have sex with men. So it's still a disease that goes into that category, although there have been some young children and some pregnant women that have been infected. But it's primarily contact with a lesion. Yes, you can get it with something that's left on a surface, a sheet or a blanket or something like that. But I wouldn't go so far as wiping seats down at crowded places and all that. I'd be more concerned with the airborne spread of COVID than I would with that.
Hmm. And anecdotally, just what's your sense of how seriously people are taking the pandemic? I mean, geez, all the way 2.5 years into it.
You know, it's a tough question to answer in terms of practicality. I mean, there are certainly a lot of people that feel the outbreak is gone and they can just go back to their normal lives. And I don't recommend that everybody mask all the time everywhere they go. So you have to reach some balance between a normal sense of life and what's practical. And maybe some kind of a compromise where if you go into crowded indoor areas, you go into bars and things like that, maybe you should wear a mask.
Thank you so much. And stressing again that really anyone can contract monkeypox. But I appreciate the perspective on that. It's Air Talk on KPCC coming up. A new guide co-authored by the American Academy of Pediatrics aims to help parents determine the right time to give their child a smartphone. Our thanks to Dr. Peter Katoma, professor of epidemiology at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health and David Geffen School of Medicine. On this kids and smartphones thing, there's a lot to consider. Many parents want to be able to reach their children directly when they're not together. We're all too aware of the negative effects that too much screen time and doom scrolling can have. Our next guest is a pediatrician who helped draft this guide and questionnaire. She'll lend us her expertise. You can call in now, 866-893-5722, and be part of this conversation. Email us at atcomments and kpcc.org. Please include your name and the part of town you're calling from. And back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary. I'm sitting in for Larry this week. Very happy to be with you. How do you know when the time is right to get your kid a smartphone? Is it about age? Should it be based on circumstance? It's a big decision. Like I said, I'm not even sure I should have one. The rabbit holes I go down. A new questionnaire co-authored by the American Academy of Pediatrics aims to help. But I want to hear from parents or guardians who are considering whether to get their kids a smartphone. What are some of your thoughts behind your decision? Or maybe your child already has one. What's been your experience? What are the pros and cons? We're taking your calls at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@kpcc.org or tweet us or comment on the Air Talk Facebook page. Tell us what your negotiation with your kids is like as they demand a smartphone and you're not sure it's the time yet. Joining me now is Dr. Jenny Radesky, developmental and behavioral pediatrician at the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. She's also vice chair of the Council on Communications and Media at the American Academy of Pediatrics, which co-authored this new questionnaire. Dr. Radesky, thanks for joining us on Air Talk.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. While we wait for some calls to come in, tell us more about the questionnaire itself and why something like this is necessary.
Yeah, we know this is such an angst-ridden decision for families, and there's a couple reasons for that. One is that we as parents did not grow up with smartphones, most of us. Maybe people have flip phones or other things, so it really feels like a brand new beast that we don't have that lived experience with, so it's harder to know how to guide our kids. So that was one rationale for the AAP joining with AT&T to try to create more supports and more guidance as families are going through this decision-making process. The second frustrating thing is that sometimes we don't have a lot of options. It's either straight from a flip phone to a smartphone. And we wanted to give some guidance on how families, if you do choose a smartphone, you know, how to set privacy settings and how to set some controls and other things and how to have conversations with your kids while you're making this decision together so that it's really a learning experience. It's not just this thing you decide to do rashly or on a whim because everyone's doing it. And the third thing that really motivated this is that we've all been through over 2 years in the pandemic of tons of screen time and tons of time really relying on the digital environment that is sometimes awesome and sometimes exhausting and time-wasting. And we think it's a really good time for families to be thinking about, you know, either resetting or rethinking their relationship with media in a way that feels healthy. It feels like, you know, we're using it in ways that support our human values rather than feeling we're being used by it, you know, so that people can make money.
So there's a questionnaire. Where do people find it? And I have thoughts about a questionnaire. You said that this is not just for parents to evaluate their kids' readiness, but for the American Academy of Pediatrics to learn from parents. What are you hoping to learn from it?
Oh, yes. So we're not collecting data through the questionnaire about what parents are reporting. We more kind of want some qualitative feedback. You know, through healthychildren.org, we can definitely would love to hear voices of parents to say, you know, was this helpful? What did it get right? What did it, you know, miss? just so that we know, you know, we're learning all the time too, and didn't want parents to feel like this is the end all be all quiz, like a, you know, a quiz in Cosmo where you're like, what should I do with my life? Here's, you know, I'll answer these questions. It's more a reflective tool to, you can find it on the AT&T website if you Google just the screen ready or the phone ready questionnaire. And then it goes through a series of different questions. So the very first one is just, who is starting the conversation about getting a phone? Is it the child who's demanding it or nagging for it? Is the parent who's saying, like, well, I have this old phone you could use, or I really need to get in touch with you? We just wanted families to pause and examine the motivation behind getting a phone instead of just jumping to buying one.
Well, does the motivation – why would the motivation make a difference?
Well, it's if the whole motivation, let's say, is to contact the child, then you have other options. You have a flip phone or some other way of communicating, like a Gab watch, that doesn't involve as many different ways to access the internet or apps or games. If the motivation is because the child feels like they're missing out and they feel this compulsion to be in touch with friends, you can say, and if the family doesn't feel ready to get the parent a phone, the child a phone, you can also find other ways to maintain contact. So let's say if they had an iPad or another way through a laptop to be texting or video chatting, those still suit the purpose and motivation of getting a phone without having to actually, you know, give your child a little computer to bring around in their pocket.
For sure.
So that's one way that, you know, anytime you're trying to make a decision with your kids is understand, okay, what is the motivation here and why do we want this? And what are some other ways that we can satisfy that need without it feeling like we've, you know, we've done something that doesn't feel comfortable for us?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit with Amy, who is calling from Torrance. Amy, how old is your son, and what are your concerns right now?
Yes, hi. Thank you so much. My son is 7, and we're definitely going through the typical struggle that perhaps a lot of parents with kids with ADHD have, where they really get down the rabbit hole, as you said, with video games, and we, you know, put limits and timers and everything. But after that, you know, Uvalde's shooting, I was just, I just really thought it'd be great to have a way to contact him. But so I've been researching phones that don't have internet, don't have apps, but, you know, have a way to, and you may have mentioned this, sorry, already, I may have missed the beginning, but, you know, give parents a way to contact their children. But, yeah, he's definitely not mature enough to get a phone with all of those other aspects until he's probably at least, like, I don't know, 12 or something.
Wow. Okay, well, let's turn that question to Dr. Radesky. Thank you very much for your question, Amy. So what are the options that are not internet-y that would still give a parent like Amy a means to communicate her child with her child during an emergency?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Amy just mentioned several things that are also in the phone readiness questionnaire that I'll get to in a second. So that was a perfect lead-in. But there are a couple of things that parents can look into. Is one, most wireless carriers do carry flip phones still. They're the least expensive, so if you're afraid your child is going to lose the phone, that's probably the best, one of the best ones. Then there's also something called Gab Wireless, which has a watch associated with it, or a phone that has very limited capabilities. So it has like text, talk, and ways to communicate with an approved set of contacts. Then there's the Pinwheel device, which is kind of a very pared down smartphone that what's nice about the design of Pinwheel is that it kind of can grow with your child. So you can start out with a very limited set of functionalities, just kind of talk and text, and then you can increase it to being a little bit more social-based, you know, a little bit more child independence. And then there's also, you know, even if, let's say you don't have the funds to pay for one of these special devices, or you want to give your child your own, say, iPhone, there are guides, like on the website Wait Until ACE, which is a an advocacy group to, like, help parents talk with each other about delaying getting a smartphone until eighth grade. They have a great blog on their website about how to, like, lock down kid's iPhone just so that they can't download apps or things without checking with you first, that there's certain content filters and screen restrictions. The main thing I want to say is that if you're going to do some sort of restrictions on the phone, do it with the child at your side so you can talk it through and be like, you know what, I don't really want you stumbling across the creepy stuff.
All good options. And we'll come back to how to have that conversation with your kid when we come back from break. We're taking your calls. What are some of the reasons behind when you decided to get your child a smartphone? Call us at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5733 or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. We'll be back with Dr. Jenny Radesky of the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in just a minute. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Welcome back. I'm Sharon McNary. And right now we're talking about when the right time is to get your child a smartphone, which can be a tough decision for parents. We are taking your calls. What's been your experience with smartphones? When did you decide it was the right time for your kid? And has it worked out? Phone line is open, 866-893-5722, or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. I'm talking with Dr. Jenny Radesky, a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. She was involved in the creation of a new questionnaire from the American Academy of Pediatrics. It aims to help parents better understand whether their kid is ready for a smartphone or not. Now, I can see how this might be a hard conversation to have with your child when we as adults spend a lot of time with our faces in our own devices. How do you have that conversation with your child in a way that doesn't come off as hypocritical?
You know, one thing that I've done is actually I took the questionnaire with my 12-year-old son sitting with me, and we went through the different parts of it. So it includes how responsible are they? Are they losing things like their gloves or their hats or their backpacks? Do they follow tech rules at home well, or are you constantly fighting about it? And that's a big one that Amy had just mentioned. You know, if you feel like, oof, we're always arguing about just video games or turning the TV off, it's going to be a lot harder with a device that they can carry around. It covers maturity and accountability. Do you trust their judgment? Do you trust that they're going to resist impulses? Or if they do make a mistake, will they automatically work to make it better? And even though my son had scored in the okay, like, yes, you're in the ready zone, we were able to have a conversation to say, hey, I don't know that we as a family need to get you this now. None of your friends yet have smartphones, so you're not missing out on anything. And let's think about how hard it was when you got sucked down rabbit holes during remote learning or when we, you know, have a hard time getting you off of Mario Kart. So using these conversations to say, why is this hard for you? Or what is it about me as a working mom that makes it hard for me to put my device down, say, on weekends when I'm, you know, should I be checking email? Should I be checking in on patients? What are the good reasons to use technology when you're around other people? And what are the things that are not worth the interruption or disruption that it's causing?
I mean, I can think of the childhood scarring experiences, you know, the fear of missing out. I mean, when I was a kid, it was my pants were too short, you know, I called them floods. Oh my God, that was just so horrible. And so, I mean, if you're the only kid in the room that doesn't have, you know, the fancy phone, I don't know if this is going to lead to a lifeline break with your kids or not.
Well, I think if you feel as a parent like you're worried that you're not ready, but your child is saying, oh my gosh, this is the worst thing ever. I'm a social pariah if I don't have this.
Which, yeah.
I mean, you can gather more information from your friends' parents if you know them and like try and figure out, okay, you know, my child might need this. You can take it in stages. You could get the phone and, you know, you could make it something where you have more restrictions on it at first, and you say, you know what, you're going to earn more and more responsibility with this phone as I see that you are capable of it, that you have a good relationship with it. If you're sneaking it, if you're bringing it into bed at night, if you're checking it when, you know, you should be doing something like driving or doing something else that you need to be paying attention, then that's a sign to me that it's hard for you to control it, and we're going to have more restrictions on it.
Talk a little bit more about those downsides, what things to look for that your kid has gone down a rabbit hole.
Right, and I think we should be really honest and non-judgmental with kids and when we say, hey, these things are distracting. Never before have you been carried around little computers that contained our social lives, all this information about the world, all of these fun games and all these, you know, silly dance routines and everything. So they're vying for our attention. There's a business reason that they're vying for our attention because it makes the people money who are posting those things. So if you can demystify for kids, hey, this is the way tech works. This is why it feels so distracting. And therefore, it's okay that you feel sucked in sometimes, and it's okay that you find yourself doom scrolling sometimes. The bigger, more important piece is being able to then recognize that and say, how can I reset a little bit? I'm not going to just feel overwhelmingly guilty. I'm going to say, you know what? I'm going to make a new rule where maybe I charge this out of my bedroom at night, or we are going to have a basket where we put these things, or mm-hmm. we're going to set timers so that, you know, TikTok for an hour is all I get, you know? And then do a little experiments where you talk about it a week later and say, how did that go? Did that actually feel better? Did you feel relieved to be able to single task a little bit?
So having those controls and feedback kind of a loop with the kids. Chris in West L.A. said he or she, I'm not sure the gender here, decided to give the daughter a phone when she transferred to middle school because it helped them coordinate pickup points. Says, I think most parents should study their child before giving them the phone. That's something we're hearing from you. And last year in fifth grade, we assigned her tasks to handle with the phone to gauge how addicted she would become to it. She looked up restaurant reviews, used the map function, and looked up quick facts on Google. We got an email from Jim in L.A. He says he's glad we're making the distinction of smartphone versus simpler phone. A lot of parents who want to communicate with their child just automatically jump to the smartphone without considering the other options. When Jim's children were younger, started conducting an informal survey of his friends and coworkers, discovered that almost everyone had given their child a smartphone at age 10 or 11. My 12-year-old daughter has a flip phone, but the pressure to get her a smartphone has begun. Going back to the questionnaire, though, one of our editors says she doesn't like these kinds of questionnaires because she feels like it makes parents feel bad that they aren't being more vigilant about their kids' screen time. I mean, the easiest thing to do is just to ignore the kid having the phone in their face 24 hours a day. How bad is all that?
You know, I know this topic in general does induce guilt and feelings of overwhelm in parents, you know, because I've been involved in writing the screen time guidelines with the AAP for years now. So I totally understand that. And that was one reason that we intentionally, when writing this, we sat down and we were like, we need to have a voice with this questionnaire and the family media plan that came along with it, that is not saying, hey, parents, here's what you have to do. And because that doesn't work anyway. As I'm a pediatrician sitting in clinic, I don't take that tone with parents either. I kind of say, who are you? Who's your child? What do you guys need right now? You know, what are the things that you, in the driver's seat, the parent deciding, you know, what is the best for my family right now? I think so many of us are moving so fast, we don't always have the time to pause and reflect. And technology itself is designed to be frictionless and fast moving. So it doesn't build in little stoppage points for us to say, did I want to do that? So that's part of the goal is the quiz is not to say, oh, you're a good parent, you're a bad parent. Not at all. It's really built with the language to help families discuss amongst themselves, reflect, and then be, you know, the ones that make their own decision.
And on that note, thank you so much to Dr. Jenny Rudesky. Been talking with you about when to get your kid a cell phone. She's in the developmental and behavioral pediatrician at the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital. That's it for Air Talk today. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle. I'll be back with you tomorrow for more Air Talk starting at 10 a.m. 1A is up next. Have a great afternoon.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.